So I'm Ewan Graham. I'm the director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. So it's under my program that Greg Colton has been leading the Pacific Fragility Project. My thanks to Greg for showing great enthusiasm, commitment to get to the point where we are. It's great that we've got the first of our analyses papers that was published yesterday. We've heard from the two other paper presenters today. Those will shortly follow online, so do please keep abreast of our website. It will all be there in due course and before long. And just to remind you as well, there is an accompanying series on our digital magazine, The Interpreter, which will be continuing to run for a little while longer. So we come to the conclusion of today, but it's not quite the conclusion of the project, and that's why this next panel session is I think, of particular importance, because this is really where it comes to the rub of what it means in concrete policy terms for Australia, which is, after all, the question that we're attempting to answer here. And although we have four illustrious and very well-qualified panellists, I'm also looking to you, the audience, to be the fifth panellist here today. And that's why we've put out a list of general questions, which I'll just briefly reprise. And if during the panel discussion, if you could keep those in your mind, and then we'll have a little bit of time at the end, I'd like to throw it back to question and answer from the floor to our panelists. And these big general questions are, what are the biggest drivers of regional instability? What drivers of instability have the biggest impact for Australian security interests? How can Australia best address these drivers of instability? How can Australia best work with like-minded regional partners to address the drivers of instability? And last, perhaps most trickily of all, what can Australia not afford not to do? We'll be coming in back to those throughout the panel discussion, but I'd like to go through those in perhaps a little bit more of a detailed and sequenced form, reprising the three panel presentations that we had earlier today from my colleague Greg Colton, as well as from Stuart Firth and Dr. Rita Parker just now. Plus, of course, we've had the introductory comments from the Minister and the detailed presentations on the maritime patrol program in the Pacific. So not to take further away from time from our panel, because time is limited, but by way of brief introduction, although many of our panelists here need no introduction, Secretary General Meg Taylor of the Pacific Islands Forum since 2014, Dame Meg served as Private Secretary to Sir Michael Somare during PNG's period of self-government and then post-independence. She has also served both as a public and private sector lawyer and was the ambassador of Papua New Guinea to the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And in 2002, she was appointed Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. Senator Concetta Fierravanti-Wells is Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific. Senator Fierravanti-Wells was elected for New South Wales in 2004 and has been the Minister since 2016, having previously served as the Assistant Minister for Multicultural Affairs. The Minister also has an extensive legal background and served as Senior Private Secretary to John Fahey, the former Premier of New South Wales. Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga is the Director General of Pacific Community. Dr. Tukui Tonga is from Niue and has served as the Director General of the Pacific Community since January 2014. He has an extensive background in the public health sector, having previously been Director of Public Health in New Zealand's ministry, and has a particular background on many of the issues that we heard about earlier today from both Dr. Firth and Dr. Parker. Our fourth panelist, Dr. James Batley, from the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University here in Canberra, is a former diplomat with extensive experience in the Pacific He served as High Commissioner to the Solomon Islands. He was High Commissioner to Fiji and was head of Australia's mission to Timor-Leste from 1999 to 2002, later going on to become Australia's first ambassador after independence. James was deputy head of AusAid and served two terms as the senior Australian civilian member of the Bougainville Truce Monitoring Group, as well as leading the regional assistance mission to the Solomon Islands, Ramsey, between 2007 and 2009. So we have an excellent panel to talk through our distilled presentations from earlier today. The other instruction I'd like to our panelists to bear in mind is not to be shy of telling us what we've missed, because this is not a complete project yet. We will be producing a report of outcomes, and we'd like to know your suggestions for where we've got gaps that can be filled. And as this is not the final word on these problems, which will run, as we've heard, in some cases more likely for decades rather than in a short-term span, your recommendations also for where we can take further research forward. So if you could just sort of keep that generally in mind. But I'd like to go in the first point of detail to this issue around population growth and urbanization. If we're looking at factors that really affect domestic resilience in Pacific Island states, our various presenters today have outlined a number of challenges that the region faces, but this certainly rises up as a key one, and which has security implications, although perhaps not security as narrowly defined under Department of Defense terminology. And perhaps I could start with you, Secretary General Meg Taylor. How has this issue of urbanization, increasing urbanization and population growth being addressed within the region? Is there anything that the Pacific Islands Forum particularly seeks from the international community, Australia included, in this area?
My understanding is that there hasn't been, of late anyway, since I've been in the position, my apologies. First of all, let me recognise the Indigenous people of this land where we are invited guests. With regard to population per se, but their focus is really much, very much on what leaders talk about in terms of the youth bulge and what are we going to do in terms of providing good education, economic opportunities for youth, and possibilities for them to be able to go abroad for further studies and also to be employed at home and internationally. So that's where the focus is, particularly on population growth. I'm in some conversations with Prime Minister of my own country, Papua New Guinea. Yes, very much concerned about the population growth in Papua New Guinea. But surveys that have been done in Papua New Guinea in the past, it's very interesting. Everybody thinks that this is because bride price is paid, that women, it's the women who think that they've got to have the children, and the male population were saying too, because they understand that they have to be able to educate these children now. And there's a land shortage in many of the highland valleys where I come from, so you have to think, if you have too many children, where are they all going to live? In terms of urbanisation, I think in some of our countries, you see Fiji has a huge urban population. So there's really the division of urban and rural is now very much blended. But the Australian National University has done some really good research in terms of what is happening in places like Port Moresby and Lae with urbanisation. And it's not generally just everybody turns up and just sits there, you know. There are arrangements that are made with different communities who own traditional land around there, where there is leasing of land so people can have a livelihood there. Is it systematically organised in our countries? I'd say no. But I think the beginning of good research has been done by academics so that we know what is happening and what countries can build on.
Thank you. Colin, as head of a hands-on delivery organisation, what practical assistance in this area would you like to see from Australia, New Zealand, the US and France?
I guess building on the comments from Stuart Firth, and also just to expand on what Dame Meg's just said, I think we have a real issue around education in our region. We run what's called the Education Quality Assessment Program, and the literacy numeracy challenges of our young people is a problem, and I keep harping on about this. Year six boys perform at the level of year four girls. And whilst we do the monitoring and the reporting and we tell anyone who wants to listen that you can't have development, you can't have personal development, you can't have prospects of good employment if you're failing at the basic level. And so education has been the factor that's missing here. I do, though, want to acknowledge the Australian New Zealand government contribution to our ECAP program. But ECAP is simply monitoring, reporting, and informing people, an important task, but then the nations and ourselves more collectively need to act on those in terms of quality of teaching and lifting literacy and numeracy skills. You're going nowhere in a hurry if you can't add. I know you. Someone mentioned today that you can be a politician, but seriously... Wipe that. Point I'm making is that Midday Mig referred to the youth bulge, and whilst it's at this stage localised to a few of our nations, it's a real issue. Uneducated, unskilled young men with no hope and no prospects is a recipe for disaster. And whilst initially, it might be contained within our region, it does have wider implications. So I'd like to see more emphasis on lifting education quality in this region. The other point I want to make, of course, is that we need to start to honour the commitments we make here for children and young people. In urbanisation, of course, drags everyone towards the urban areas, and we heard already about the lack of services in many of these places, and often the children are the ones that miss out. And again, I didn't hear any focus on the well-being and the development opportunities for children. So that would be my second contribution to this conversation.
Thank you. James Batley, the Secretary General referenced research that's been done in ANU. I understand you've been heavily involved in that on urbanisation in Honiara in particular. Do you think that Australian policy is currently adequately flexible enough to address this area?
Well, I'd say the Australian government system's flexible enough to consider it, but I think there's a lot of competing priorities, and it to my mind, it hasn't really crystallised as an issue of policy focus at the moment. I mean, having said that, I'd make that initial point that there's a lot of other issues, that there's a lot of competing demands on the aid program. I was in Honiara just a couple of weeks ago, and I have to say it really strikes you as a real choke point of the country that... there is a big roads project going on at the moment, but from one end of Honiara right through out the other side, it's just jam-packed with vehicles. And clearly, the economy of that place is choking because of the lack of adequate infrastructure. So that's just a small sign. But, I mean, I do think that's an area that is going to require serious policy attention. I mean... from a government like Solomon Islands, first and foremost.
Minister, you've heard the other panellists speaking on this issue, so I think it's appropriate to give you the opportunity now to say what Australia is doing from a policy standpoint in this area of urbanisation and population growth.
Well, thank you very, very much. Can I just, first of all, start by thanking Loie for holding today? I think it's been really, really productive. And can I particularly acknowledge Dame Meg and the other crop agencies heads who are here? we spend a lot of time talking about nuts and bolts, and it's really good to be able here in Australia and to be able to share some of the challenges that we do face in the Pacific with the audience that we have today. But just on that, just three things if I could say. I think in terms of population growth and urbanisation, there's the physical, and when we talk about physical, we talk about the infrastructure, and of course Australia spends about 16% of its overseas development assistance in the infrastructure space, and that's about the practical things, helping people get around, but helping also in the practical things like improving access to electricity. And James, you mentioned about Honiara, and of course one of the things that's very important for Solomon Islands is electricity, and of course the work that we're doing with the Tina River hydro electric hydro power project is a very good example of the practical, where we're bringing together work from the Asian Development Bank, Australia, technical assistance, some assistance money, and really embarking on a big project. So there's the physical part of assisting the practical day-to-day of urbanisation. But as Dame Mick said, it's really also about the young people. It's about the opportunities. It's about education. And last year, our ODA spent almost 20% of our ODA was in education. So therefore, when we do have a situation like a natural disaster, one of our highest priorities is to ensure that our schools get back on deck. So we saw that after Tropical Cyclone Winston. Why is that so very important? Because it's important to get the children back to school and ensure that their education continues. So there's the education at both the primary and the secondary level, and I know that there's a lot more that we can do in that space. But then there's the labour mobility component, and I think one of the good things that Australia has done in this space is to afford opportunity. And we've seen with the seasonal worker program, I think it was discussed earlier, it's been a very successful program and has remitted a lot of money back into the Pacific, and is a very important avenue for stability, for economic stability. And that's why we're really excited about our labour mobility scheme and expanding labour mobility in the Pacific. And whilst seasonal worker program was basically focused in the agriculture and horticultural sector, our labour mobility scheme will look at opportunities for up to 3 years in health, in aged care, and in tourism and accommodation at the certificate 2, 3, and 4 level. It's not just about the remittances, it's about the capacity building, because that's the other part of it. It's capacity building in the Pacific so that Pacific Island countries can then take those skills and effectively increase their economic viability through increased capacity. So these are some of the practical ways. So it's really at different stages that I think you have to deal with these issues.
All right. Now, overcrowding also caused by urbanisation feeds into some of the health challenges that we heard about. And again, to recall Stuart Firth's presentation, there was a fair emphasis on non-communicable diseases, which may currently account for up to 70% of mortality rates in the Pacific Islands region, a really sobering statistic. So, Colin, perhaps with your competence in and background in public health, I'll come to you first. Are countries such as Australia funding the right projects areas in terms of public health, and what more should be done?
We're getting increasing support from Australia, but let me just run through the components of what the health components are that contribute to instability and health risks. I mean, the classic is, of course, infectious diseases, and we saw some information on SARS as an example. As it happened, I was
Director of Public Health in New Zealand at the time. And classically, the public concern, the outrage associated with an infectious disease outbreak, in fact, almost always exceeds the actual risk from that particular threat. So infectious diseases is a big one. We heard today from someone on the drug-resistant TB. TB, by the way, remains a problem in only some of the islands in the region. By and large, the others have done reasonably well. But the new risk here is drug-resistant TB. And if we also extend that out, there's now an increasing share of the population that have both diabetes and TB. And you know, the two things aggravate each other. And someone with diabetes, for example, is more susceptible. And so this is the one that we're all familiar with, of course, is HIV/AIDS, and that continues to be an issue, again, in some parts of our region. But that's the classic. On NCDs, I see this is the big one for Micronesia and Polynesia, and actually for all of us. Hypertension and heart disease is a problem in Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea. It's just that their profile's a little different. But for NCDs, there are two problem areas. One is access to drugs. We know simple medication for hypertension and diabetes can make a difference, but people do not have access on a regular basis, and that's one of the big problems in our region, access to effective, cost-effective medication for common problems. The second is, and hasn't been mentioned here, is access to dialysis. This is already cropping up repeatedly, particularly in relation to Polynesian nations and New Zealand. It will probably come to Australia, I don't know, but we have to anticipate this because the burden of complications from all of the new non-communicable diseases is not yet appreciated or realised. Yeah? So this is a big one. Now, climate change and natural disasters, of course, is a big area, and climate change fundamentally changes the socio-economic, cultural determinants of health. And I don't want to bore you by repeating this, but it is an important area for us to be even more active, and particularly from Australia, in relation to climate change, the health impacts of climate change. And we've already heard the support to natural disasters. Lastly, you will have heard that the French Navy, the French Defence Forces, intercepted two yachts in recent times with a significant amount of illicit drugs. Whether they're destined for our region or through our region to Australia and New Zealand, of course, is an issue. But the point is that we already have some evidence out of Samoa and elsewhere about concerns about illicit drugs. And, you know, the associated things that go with the trafficking or the dissemination of illicit drugs are pretty obvious. And again, I think we need to pay attention to this. The Pacific is not immune, and I imagine the people who are the region don't have the detection capability and so on. But again, I mentioned this because it is a risk. It is an issue that's associated with instability and has security risks. And again, I didn't hear it raised here. And it's important to keep that on the agenda as well. Sorry, I've gone on a bit.
No, thank you. That's valuable, and it's also a public health and law enforcement concern that is directly relevant to Australia. So preventing that at the maximum range is, of course, something in Canberra's own interest as well. Dame Meg, I mean, arguably, public health is the most basic component of resilience. From the forum's point of view, what more needs to be done?
On public health?
And particularly from external assistance, Australia especially.
It's not something I think about a lot. I think that the interventions that used to happen when we had AusAid particularly around public health in many of the Pacific countries. On HIV/AIDS were substantial. But the decision of the leaders in 2015 to look at cervical cancer raised gasps in some communities by saying, how on earth did that ever get on their agenda? Well, it's one of the biggest killers of women in the region, not just in places like Papua New Guinea, but if you go to Micronesia and in the Federated States of Micronesia, Kiribati, lots of our women are dying from cervical cancer. What we'd like to see is that when decisions are made at the Pacific Island Forum, and in particular to do with health issues for the region, that donor countries get behind it. Yet it's been very hard to mobilise funds. SPC and PIF have been working very closely with UNICEF on this, and we engaged ADB to see if we can get funding from there to make sure that we can have inoculations as well as screening and treatment for women. I'd like to see Australia very focused on a couple of key issues, and I know they have been very supportive of HIV in Papua New Guinea and, of course, in tuberculosis. Collins addressed these issues, particularly around non-communicable diseases. That is also something that we as Pacific Island peoples have to really take control of in terms of our own dependency on our local food rather than imported food, and an education on building healthier societies or healthier communities for ourselves. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. James, I want to switch tack with you now and take things up to perhaps more traditional defence and security agenda. If we're looking at regional frameworks in the Pacific, the Bika Tower Declaration is deemed to have been a success story for laying the framework for regional security. You were head of RAMSI in the Solomon Islands, which in many ways was made possible by the provisions laid out in that declaration. We've heard that there's a broad consensus in favour of drafting a Bika Tower Plus agreement. What do you think should be amended from the original declaration and included within it?
So just to take it back one step, some of the research that we've recently done at ANU was to look at the impact that RAMSI had, not in Solomon Islands, but amongst the police forces that comprised RAMSI. So a number of us went and interviewed a lot of the police from a range of countries that contributed to RAMSI to get a sense of their feelings about contributing to the mission and what their feelings were afterwards. And what was clear was that for many of the Pacific Island police officers that participated in RAMSI, was really a life experience for them. It was an absolute career highlight, and they felt that they had personally benefited. They'd gone back and returned skills to their home police forces. But there was a bit of a sense that what didn't happen was that the networks that had been established during RAMSI, some of them continued informally for a little while, but they weren't maintained. There wasn't a proactive attempt at maintaining those networks. And I think there was a desire amongst the people that we talked to see that happen. So I think I kind of take that sentiment and when you're thinking about, well, what comes after Bika Tower? What does Bika Tower Plus look like? I think maybe it's not so much for an Australian to say what should be in Bika Tower Plus. I think one of the great benefits of Bika Tower itself was its open-endedness and its flexibility. And I think really the key point I'd make about Bika Tower Plus is don't over-engineer it. Don't try and turn it into too much of a mechanical device. I think the power of Bika Tower, the original Bika Tower Declaration, lay in its language and the way people committed themselves to it, not to any systems that it actually established.
Minister, perhaps that's the best question best put to you. Would you agree that Bika Tower is perhaps not something to be tinkered with? What's the Australian view on what needs to be included in any expanded agreement, if indeed one is necessary?
Can I just pick up on following on from what James just said? I mean, Bikatawa originated. Bikatawa was the framework under which we went in, and the Pacific family needed to resolve the issues surrounding what happened in the Solomon Islands. So it was the framework that was the background to our intervention in the Ramsey mission. So as a consequence of the end of Ramsey, this sentiment has developed that all those positive things, all that training, all those things that the family, the Pacific family, came together to resolve this problem now needed to be harnessed in a particular way. And that's how I think Bikatawa Plus has now developed. But of course, today we're talking about not necessarily a same, as the Minister Payne was saying this morning, not necessarily a same situation. Today, I think it's about what I term small S security. Small S security is, as Colin has correctly said, it's about drug trafficking, it's about unregulated, unreported and illegal fishing, it's about transnational crime, it's about those that framework and how we now deal with those challenges. So I think to some extent it's about the people-to-people linkages as well, and that's part of the reason why Australia is now keen to establish a security college, an Australian Pacific Security College, which builds on those people-to-people linkages. So it's shorthand for a broader relationship, which I think now has to deal with the contemporary challenges that the Pacific face, but building on the positive things. Like, for example, after Ramsey, when you look at the police force in the Solomon Islands, it's a professional police force, a third of which the new recruits are women. I mean, this is a completely different police force, which is now dealing with a new set of challenges, a contemporary set of challenges, and I think that's the sort of thing that I would envisage will be the work and will be the framework that will lead up to Bikatawa Plus. Let's not forget Bikatawa Plus actually came out of the discussion by Pacific Island countries following Ramsey.
That's a great segue to bring in the Secretary General. After all, the forum has ownership of the Bikatawa Declaration. What's your perspective, Dame Meg?
So currently, we are in the early stages of preparing to write or draft what Bikatawa Plus should look like. So we've been having consultations right around the Pacific with governments, private sector, civil society. And it's, I think what's important is that many people, of course, we recognise and thank Australia for the intervention to help with Solomon Islands. But people always ask, is everything okay in the Solomon Islands? And the issues that may continue around land, etc., is something that the Solomon Islands people will have to resolve. But the definition of security, is very different when we started asking people, what would you want in a document that deals with regional security? And it was about the human issues. Food security was a very, very big issue. Why food security? The climate change impact is on the minds of everybody all the time. And young people particularly raise that, and you think, I was really surprised when I go to visit our governments, I asked to have time with young people in the colleges, and food security, because they think about the future, that if we have the climatic impacts that we're having on a consistent basis, there's not going to be the land for the food, and also the impact on oceans and the sustainability of the food stock within the oceans as well, that people will be hungry. Other issues that they raise that they want to be considered in the Bikatawa, and which is going to be a challenge in how you bring this all together, is security of land, land tenure. What's going to happen? Because these are at the heart of the conflicts that emerge within our own communities, but also in our countries. So security having a much more human face, and how we're going to deal with that, how we're going to support each other, in the years to come, not just in terms of the military security issues or interventions, but particularly around climatic impact.
Thank you. Colin, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, just on, obviously, Dame Meg is the leader on the development of this SBC, will contribute the advice. Some of those points I've already mentioned, particularly the health risks and potential contribution to security challenges. Just a couple of things. One is that I would add water to the food security issue. We actually have a real problem with access to clean water in our region. And it's always a problem. In RMI, FS, constant droughts. And we have a program of smart people who help nations with water. But it's an access to clean water is an ongoing challenge in small island nations. The second part of my intervention is that we do at SBC some work that doesn't make it into the declaration itself. But we have a sizable program on maritime boundaries, for example. We work with member states, supported by Australia and others, to try to delineate maritime boundaries between our members. And if you think through that, clearly you have to have some agreements on who owns where the lines are. So whilst in and of themselves they don't contribute to the declaration, but nonetheless, a critical piece of the puzzle as we formulate the declaration itself.
Just on those maritime boundary issues, the long-term issues concern is that if climate impact continues the way it is and we lose land and we don't exist, what happens to our maritime boundaries? What's the security of that when international instruments like UNCLOS don't have a provision for that? Should we ask the Chinese to come and help us build artificial islands? That woke you all up, didn't it? but these are issues that leaders are thinking about, because they know that if they lose the EEZ, then access to the fish stock, but also access to other resources in there. And the big question is, we don't look at it just in the parameter of the EEZ. If these we look through the lens of ecology, and should we be looking at biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction, and what's the treaty there? What's that going to happen when we as specific countries are going to demand that we have access to this?
Well, I'm the very opposite of a Pacific specialist, but I understand on UNCLOS, the position is that maritime boundaries are unaffected by natural erosion of the features. So the boundary, the baselines, should in theory remain the same. So I don't know if that's a measure of consolation. If you're not on an island that anymore exists, except in legal terms, probably not so. But from a resource conservation perspective, there may be something there. I'd like to go back to the subject of our first presentation by Greg Colton. What also strikes me, perhaps there's no obvious way to unify what are these intrinsically domestic security human factors with the geopolitical context. But I think we have to go back to that geopolitical context, after all, not least mindful of the impact ultimately on defences calculus here in policy terms. And although this goes wider than questions around China and China's role, we've heard also about new players in the region that are taking more of a geopolitical interest. Russia was mentioned, but China obviously stands out by scale and scope, even if there are questions about whether there is an underlying strategy or grand design. So maybe, James, I can throw that to you first. You've been involved in the region intimately over decades. What are your views about Chinese engagement in the region, and are there geopolitical fault lines that we need to worry about here?
Yeah, I have to say it helps to have a bit of a sense of history, because I remember being on my first posting in Vanuatu in 1987 and watching a Soviet naval vessel come in steam into Vila Harbour, and there was sort of a bit of panic in Western capitals at the time, and, you know, the Russians are coming. And, of course, that was the time when Libya, Vanuatu was developing a relationship with the Libyan government, again causing, you know, great concern. I guess I do think the rise of China in the region is qualitatively different from those sorts of that sort of intervention in the past, and it's a, you know, it's a fact of life for Australia. It's not a problem that you solve. It's an issue that you work with and you manage, and I think, you know, it's not addressed necessarily at the level of you know, high international geostrategy. It's addressed also at the level of relationships between states. So I'm thinking of, you know, the people-to-people relationships between Australia and Pacific Island countries that are developed through things like expanded labour mobility will over time develop relationships that strengthen ties between us. It's not, I think, having Australian diplomats walk into foreign ministries in the region and say, you really need to be aware, you know, wary of China's presence in the region. That has less of an impact, I think, and it's both in the short and long term. I think it's that the long-term relationships that we can build and work on over a really long, over the long term, having a, you know, that long-term perspective, is really the right response.
Secretary General, from a foreign perspective, where you sit and view the region, do you see, is China more opportunity than threat? What could China be doing differently, better moving forward?
Oh, I don't define what China should do. China's very clear what its agenda is, and that is to come in and fill the gap on infrastructure. In recent conversations, that's what China has made very clear, that we do things that others don't do. And that is, we will build the roads, we will build the ports, we will build what the countries want. So I think they do that. They also provide opportunities, both bilaterally and through the regional mechanism of the forum, education, scholarships for students to go and live in China and study in China. And a bit despondent that not enough of our young people continue to live there and make a life in Beijing, but most of our island people like to come home. So that's the main focus that I see with China, but I think what's happening again is that the tensions between the countries of the Pacific Island Forum that recognise Taiwan and the countries that recognise the One China policy it's been exacerbated, particularly with the election of the new president in Taiwan and the position they have taken. The recent visit of the president of Taiwan to the Pacific. And every time we have our regional meetings, this tension gets more intense.
Thank you for flagging that. I think it's a timely reminder that the Pacific, South Pacific region is Taiwan's now largest source of diplomatic support. So it is a fault line that does play out actively in that region. Minister, I'd like to turn to you now on this same question, but also bring into it an alliance perspective, if you like, because I think it's clear that the US administration takes a harder-nosed view of China, has been described in terms of a revisionist power in the official national security strategy and the national defence strategy, at least the public summary that's available of it, as an expression of US, a shift in US perception and policy. How does that come home to roost for Australia's view of China's role in the Pacific? Do you have concerns about Beijing's influence?
Well, I think there's no doubt that in our Foreign Affairs White Paper sets out the fact that China is a growing influence in our area. I think focusing on the Pacific, the issues really that we're talking about, and we're talking about particularly here, is we do welcome the involvement of all countries in terms of development of the Pacific. We need to support sustainable growth. We have to meet priorities that are important for the peoples of the Pacific. But at the same time, we shouldn't be imposing heavy debt burdens on countries in the Pacific. And that's really where the point that I'm coming from. I think it's important to distinguish in terms of investment in the Pacific region between loans and aid. Australia has an overseas development assistance budget of $3.9 billion, of which 90% of this is spent in the Indo-Pacific region, a third of that actually in the Pacific. Australia's assistance to the Pacific is in terms of, overwhelmingly in terms of aid, overseas development assistance. Now that's different to lending money, and I think that that's really important. Infrastructure is very important, health is very important, all of these issues are very important, but there has to be a productive end to the investment that donors do make. So I think it's important for us to distinguish, and I'm very pleased to see that Lowy has done some of this work on its website when you start looking at the support that different countries have given to the Pacific. And when you do look at, just going on some of your figures, since 2006, I think you're saying that we've given $7.7 billion in terms of funding. And when you compare that with other countries, I think you have to outline that Australia has given it in terms of aid as opposed to loans. And that really does make a huge difference, because a loan will, whatever its terms, impose a debt burden. And the important thing is the ability of a particular country to meet that debt burden. So, from Australia's perspective, our primary concern is ensuring that there is effective overseas development assistance. It's effective aid, but it does support sustainable growth, but it does not do so in a way that imposes a heavy debt burden.
Excellent, thank you. I'd now like to go back to you, our de facto fifth panel member, the audience, for a round of comments and questions. The floor is yours. John O'Prite from the Lowy Institute.
Thank you, our distinguished panel. Often in the Pacific, my question is directed to you, Dame Taylor and you, Colin. Often in the Pacific, when we're faced with a challenge or an opportunity, the knee-jerk response is to do more, to throw more money at it, to host a summit, or to do whatever. But my question to you is, what should Australia be doing less of? What would you like to be seen us doing less of in the region, and with regards to our engagement in the Pacific?
You can go first.
I'm taking notes, Colin.
Well, firstly, to say that I think it's a misnomer to consider the solution we have to things is to throw money at it. We at SBC, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, developed a strategic partnership with the DFAT. Money is one part of this. But in fact, we place quite a lot of interest and emphasis on skills from Australia. So for example, we have an excellent partnership with ACR supporting agricultural developments in our region. In other words, if anything, actually, my preference would be somebody with the skills and expertise that don't require us to manage. See, money can be a problem sometimes, so I just want to correct that. Of course, we would always want to be able to resource the priorities that we have, but it's not always about money. And increasingly, partnerships, CSIRO, ACR, some of the universities. What should Australia do less of? Let me think about that.
Me too. I actually don't think I know enough about what Australia actually does in the full gambit of everything. I mean, I learned a lot today listening to all the defence people speak about what they actually do. I mean, our sister agency, Foreign Fisheries, has a lot to do with the defence side of things. But then you've got our political relationship with the Australian government and DFAT, and then there's a lot of things that Australia funds that sometimes I have to ask who funded that, and then somebody will tell me, oh no, that's an Australian program. Right across the Pacific, there's all these different things. It'd be good to have a booklet that says exactly what Australia's intervention is. What I'd like to see more of, though, is really the building of the relationships between our countries and our peoples. And Australia just taking it a little bit more slowly and listening to what the leadership is really thinking about and what they're asking. Or they may not be asking for anything, but they just want to have a consultation that is not driven, but just a serious conversation.
We'll take that, the Secretary General's cue there as a future research project for the Lowy Institute to identify what less is more. And other questions from the floor? Now, I'm going to break protocol and ask my colleague Anna Kirk from the Melanesia Programme to exercise her right as the microphone holder.
Yes, conveniently I have a microphone. As Ewan said, my name's Anna Kirk, and I manage a project at the Institute called the Australia-Papua New Guinea Network, which is working to build those links that Dame Meg spoke about earlier between Australians and Papua New Guineans. And I had a question for the panel about what role you think traditional culture should play in these discussions about regional security and resilience. I was just thinking about Jonathan's comments earlier about resilience and how that hasn't been a big focus of today's discussion, and also comments on urbanisation and increasing young populations and lack of opportunities and this sort of landlessness and loss of traditional knowledge and culture and what that might mean for the future.
We're putting together a publication. I'm not talking about Australia, I'm just talking about the members of SBC. We're putting together a publication on traditional knowledge and as a forms of knowledge and a potential contribution to the conventional wisdom that we apply to things. So if you think about agricultural practices, for example, there's a whole host of sound, effective traditional practices that are used throughout the Pacific that leads to sustainable yields from agriculture, and very consistent with the high interest around organics, for example, and the practices thereof. Fisheries, coastal fisheries, conservation type interventions practiced by communities throughout the years, lots and lots and lots. And so I guess our hope in putting the publication together is that it then is part and parcel of the overall approach that we have in terms of our advice and support to our members. Legitimate and potentially very useful contribution to the overall knowledge base that we have. So yeah, without question.
In the consultations we had on Bikitawa, it was very interesting what came up around culture. There was a sentiment that we're losing a lot of our traditions and culture, but those of us who hold on to them, how can we utilise our traditional knowledge for conflict resolution? How can we use that as an instrument in solving the problems in our own communities when problems arise? But there's also a revival in many parts of the Pacific, particularly with regard to navigation and the seafaring. So to me, that's given a new impetus in the region in terms of looking at the traditional practices of navigation from the north that has been passed back into Polynesia, and now young people sailing around the Pacific. That gives us a sense of identity, really building on the narrative that the leaders want us to talk about, is that we are the blue Pacific. We are an ocean continent, and it's only through being together that we will be able to manage our livelihoods and some of the much bigger problems that we will face. So it's not, I don't believe it's all lost. I think that you visit our countries, there's culture is changing, but it happens all over the world.
Would either of our Australian panellists like to try answering that?
Sorry, can I just add, on that point, just 2 points, if I can, by way of example more than anything. I was in Vanuatu last year, and we funded a project as part of Law and Order project, where we looked at customary law and how customary law can interact, particularly in the issue of domestic violence. And we put together some work there. And it was a very valuable exercise, because we were able then to put together a framework that could then ultimately go forward, because of course it's very important if you are seeking to achieve objectives, particularly in relation to a difficult issue such as domestic violence, that customary law does play, or custom does play a part in that. But another one was in the recent COP23. We saw Fiji's presidency of COP23, and Prime Minister Bainimarama very much took to the international stage the whole concept of the dialogue, the Talanoa, and the sitting around and the dialogue. And as we had the discussion, and following on from what Dame Meg said, as part of the lead up to COP23, we really saw that in action, and we really saw that concept being taken forward on an international stage. So I think that culture, and in terms of those cultural traditions, is very important in the Pacific, and often to achieve an end result, as Dame Meg correctly pointed out, it's really important to ensure that you do the dialogue in the appropriate way.
We're coming up right to the end of our time on the panel, but the gentleman in the second row has been patiently waiting. I just ask you to keep your question as brief as possible.
Satish Chan from the University of New South Wales. Minister, I just want to go back to your distinction between debt and grant with respect to development assistance. While on first thought it would appear as though grants are better than debt, and surely, in the case where debt is above sustainable levels, then fiscal management becomes a big problem. But in some circumstances, you could actually argue the very opposite, where you would say better than a grant. And let me be very specific and short. In the case where you're taking a debt, and think of yourself as taking a debt, at least you have the discipline of investing that debt such that it is able to generate the revenues to be able to service the debt. In contrast to a grant, and if you know that the grant is going to be ongoing forever, then no such discipline exists. So I think we have to be a bit more careful when we are distinguishing between debt and grant. The second point I'd make, and this is with respect to China, is that in the case where the debt is concessional, the difference in terms of the interest rate you'd pay on normal commercial debt vis-a-vis what they charge is still official development assistance. The concession in itself is ODA. Thank you.
I think that this is a very complex area, and often you can have grants, you can have loans, or you can have a combination. I think what we're starting to see now is, particularly with the greater involvement of the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank, and the availability of greater amount of money in the Pacific, we're starting to see a lot more a combination of that, and particularly policy-driven loans, which are for big ticket items, which often cannot be done with small loans. So I think that in the end, irrespective, the point still, my point was that you cannot and we don't want to impose unnecessary debt burdens. So whatever the combination is, it does come back to that basic point to ensure that there is sustainable growth, to ensure that we do achieve the priorities that do want to be achieved, but without imposing unnecessary debt burdens on countries.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you to all four panellists for enriching our discussion here today, and to you also for your questions and observations. We will take those forward and make sure that they're reflected in the outcomes report of the conference. So, Secretary-General Meg Taylor, Minister Concetta Fierraventi-Wells, Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga, Dr. James Batley, could I ask you please to stay in your seats just for a little while longer, and you in the audience to show your appreciation for an excellent panel session, please. Thank you. The final honour goes to our sponsor for the project. Last but certainly not least in that respect, I would like to extend thanks on behalf of the Institute and personally to the Strategic Policy and Intelligence Group in the Department of Defense. And here to represent today is the Acting First Assistant Secretary, Steve Moore. Steve commenced his role as Acting First Secretary in April of this year, and has responsibility for leading Defence's international engagement agenda across the board, but including within that think tank engagement with institutes such as ourselves. He does have some form with the Pacific, having joined the department in 2006, but has also managed in that time the Australia-New Zealand defence relationship. I count New Zealand as a Pacific Island country. He's also had responsibility for defence relationships with Kiribati, with the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of Marshall Islands, and the Cook Islands. So to give some concluding remarks today, please extend a warm hand to Steve Moore.
Thank you. And I realise that there's the promise of a rooftop reception between as soon as I finish speaking, so I will try and keep this brief. I'd like to acknowledge the work that Lowy does. You're always a force for policy debate and provide us food for thought, though I'd especially like to thank you for your choice of distinguished guests here today. We've heard from Dame Meg Taylor already and from Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga, but there's a couple of others that I'd like to acknowledge as well. We have Mr. Kosi Latu from South Pacific Regional Environment Group, and also Mr. James Movic from the Director General of the Foreign Fisheries Agency. And I think the fact that you are able to be here today and add to our debate is fantastic. I'd also like to commend the Lowy Institute on hosting today's meeting. Enhancing Pacific security through regional resilience is a topic worthy of lengthy discussion, and hopefully today's discussion is only the start of that debate. I suspect there's going to be a lot more thought-provoking discussions as a result of the things we've heard today. Australia's security interests are inherently tied to security and stability in the Pacific, and we've heard that today. However, we've also learned that the challenges faced by the Pacific are complex and multifaceted, and as Dr. Parker pointed out, interrelated. We recognise that instability in our region, whether it's caused by variable economic growth, crime, poor governance, or natural disasters, have the strategic consequences for Australia. In an increasingly uncertain security environment in the Asia-Pacific and an increasingly globalised world, these security challenges will continue to evolve and reverberate across our region. As we look ahead towards future defence engagement in the Pacific, we're mindful that we need to be more active, adaptable, and engaged so that we can positively shape and influence this strategic environment. Australia recognises that we cannot respond to emerging security challenges and achieve strategic interests alone. In fact, no country can. Moving forward and being mindful of some of the things that we've heard today, we see that there's increased opportunities for engagement in the Pacific through building resilience with Pacific Island countries, through the provision of capacity development and training support under the auspices of the Defence Cooperation Program, through fostering greater regional cooperation between Pacific Island countries on maritime security issues, through working closely with like-minded partners to ensure a coordinated approach to the region, and through seeking opportunities to align the Defence Cooperation Program with the broader efforts in the region. Given Australia's key strategic interests in the Pacific, it's critical that we continue to coordinate activities with regional partners. Closely coordinating our respective operations, exercises, and capacity building initiatives, such as training, it ensures that we're strategically aligned with our partners in the Pacific and those that we're working with in the Pacific. To achieve this, Australia, along with our regional partners, will continue to support and strengthen regional security frameworks and mechanisms. This includes reinforcing the Pacific Islands Forum as the preeminent regional forum engagement to engage on security issues, and includes the South Pacific Defence Ministers meeting as the only ministerial level defence meeting in the South Pacific, which plays an important role in regional security architecture. This regional security architecture plays a critical role in facilitating coordinated and effective regional responses to natural disasters and other threats. As the Minister for Defence mentioned in her speech earlier today, we're a maritime community of nations and we need a collective maritime certainty. Because of this, maritime security cooperation will remain the cornerstone of Australia's defence engagement with the South Pacific. As the Minister noted, the Pacific Patrol Boat Program has long been the centrepiece of Australia's Defence Cooperation Program of the Pacific, and that will continue. Its successor, the Pacific Maritime Security Program, will build on the decades-long assistance provided through the Patrol Boat Program and includes new replacement patrol boats, integrated aerial surveillance, and enhanced regional coordination. This will assist Pacific Island countries to enhance the effectiveness of their patrol boats and protect their regional sovereignty and resources. The Minister also mentioned that our support for the Pacific must remain adaptable and flexible to the needs and priorities facing our partners in the Pacific. In addition to continuing our bilateral programs of assistance and training, as well as introducing the PMSP, we have to ask ourselves a number of questions, and some of those have been asked today. What else might or could we do? Is the Australian support adaptable and flexible enough? How much is enough, and is there a timeline for the delivery of that support? Should we consider whether we can deliver the same effect in different ways? And as people have said today, is there a measure for success? These questions are questions we will continue to ask ourselves, and I'd like to thank Greg Carter this morning for his recommendations to start that thought process. And finally, I agree with Greg's comments that our relationships with Pacific neighbours must be a partnership. Like the evolution of the patrol boat and its replacement, the PMSP, working with Pacific partners and neighbours to find lessons learned will be key to deliver adaptable and flexible solutions. It's only through collaboration and agility that we will protect our security interests in the region and enhance our ability to respond to emerging challenges and opportunities. Thank you.
Minister Dame Meg Cropheads, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the formal part of today's gathering of like minds on the Pacific. Thank you very much.